SF Signal, episode number 20, Milestone. Everyone had to start somewhere, so tonight our panel discusses what was your gateway genre novel, did you ever read it again, and did it still have that same magic as the first time? This is the SF Signal Podcast, episode number 20, as powered by the Functional Nerds. My name is Patrick Hester. I'm an author, a blogger, and an all-around functional nerd. And tonight I am joined by a gaggle of the folks who bring us SF Signal each and every week. Let's go down the line here and say hello. Say hello, DiNardo.
How you doing? John DiNardo here from SF Signal.
Matthew Sanborn Smith, not to be confused with Doctor Who.
Well, you can confuse me with Doctor Who. I'm a liver of life, dreamer of dreams, mangoer of mangoes.
Lisa, hello.
Hello, good evening. How is everyone tonight?
We're bummed because now we don't get any more recaps of SGU until they come back.
I know, I don't know what I'm going to do. I might have to recap, I don't know, Sanctuary or something to get my fix.
That's a bummer. Hey, Larry.
Hi, Patrick. How are you?
Good. Tell everybody who you are, just in case they don't know.
I'm Larry Ketrasid, and I'm still trying to get DiNardo's fingerprints off of my iPad.
I was playing with his Kindle and iPad.
Yay. Yeah, you got to be careful. He has Windows cooties. Hi, Karen.
Hey, Patrick.
That's
it? I think everyone knows me by now.
Okay. Hi, Jessica.
Hi, I'm Jessica Strider. I blog at scififanletter.blogspot.com.
Jeff Patterson.
Hi, Jeff Patterson, wearing pants.
And Fred. Hi, Fred.
Hi, it's Fred Kish from The Lensman's Children, and I'm still trying to find my copy of Greetings, Carbon-Based Life Forms. Someone, which one of you listeners has got it?
Someone checked it out of the library, huh? Yeah, they have software you can have on your computer that tracks who you loan out your books to. It's called Excel.
Well, only works if they borrow it when I'm around.
All right, well, let's get going here because there's no telling how long Jeff's pants will stay on. Everyone had to start somewhere. So this week's topic is, what was your gateway genre novel? Did you ever read it again? And did it still have that same magic as the first time? Let's start in the middle and ask Larry.
You going to start with me, huh? Well, DiNardo knows exactly what I'm going to say. He already accused me of this at lunch, but I started reading Doc Savage and Edgar Rice Burroughs novels when I was very, very young. First time in Houston, I've read almost all 186 of the Doc Savage novels, and I'm actually just starting to read them again. They are one of the original superhero novels. The original Doc Savage pulps were written in the 30s, and Bantam brought them back in the 60s. I guess I'm dating myself. I guess I'm the oldest person on this podcast. I'll calculate that quick. I know DiNardo's younger than I am, and I know all the ladies by definition are younger than I am. But the thing that really got me going with Doc Savage was the creativity from the authors in that time frame predicting different things that have all come to pass. Different types of airplanes, different types of tools, different types of weapons, which when you read them now seem rather mundane, but when you put them in the context of the 30s when they were written, they were pretty fantastic. There's a lot of thievery from Doc Savage. Doc Savage had a Fortress of Solitude long before Superman did. I think the entire DC universe was stolen from Doc Savage, but we won't get into that. And I soon got into Edgar Rice Burroughs for the same reason. The whole Barsoom series, which is sitting on my shelf in front of me, it was just classic. I'm running around the Arizona desert. Oops, I got transported to Mars. There's a beautiful naked Martian princess and a large green four-armed Thark that's going to come after me. You know, when you're in elementary school, that's fascinating stuff. I devoured every Edgar Rice Burroughs book, and I have them all and collect them.
Did you said that there was like 100-something books in Doc Savage?
There are 186 Doc Savage books. They put out 92 individual novels in the Bantam series, And then they began putting them out as doubles, and there's about 13 doubles. And then they began putting them out as what they called omnibus series, which have four or five stories per, and there's 13 of those.
You know what that reminds me of is Remo Williams.
Yeah, interestingly enough, there's a lot of cross-writing. The pseudonym of the group of writers who wrote Doc Savage is Kenneth Robeson, and it was really written, the majority of them were by a gentleman named Lester Dent. And some of the other authors have written Remo Williams. The gentleman who finished the series is a gentleman named Will Murray. And DiNardo gifted me with the audio version when we met at lunch, which Will Murray had a big part of. And he has gotten permission to restart the Doc Savage series. He's got four of Lester Dent's outlines that he's putting together.
Wow, that's amazing.
So can I just jump in here for a sec? Do you like those Doc Savage now as much as you did when you were young?
I actually like them for different reasons, and I think the answer is yes, I do. When I was reading them as a kid, I couldn't put them in the context that they were written in. They were written from the 30s until the 50s, so there's a real political undertone to the stories as the start of World War II comes into play, and World War II comes into play, and even the Cold War afterwards, and I just didn't get that when I was a kid reading them. And putting them in context of what time period they were written and what was creative, I'm just fascinated rereading them. I really do enjoy going through them.
Awesome. Jessica, why don't you go?
My book was The Sword of Shannara by Terry Brooks. My brothers actually gave it to me for Christmas when I was 9 or 10 because they wanted to read the first trilogy, and it sat on my bookshelf for several years because I thought the premise was really stupid. You know, this guy who has no powers, who can't, you know, he's just regular plain guy, no magic, no sword ability, anything. Goes against the most powerful evil force the world has ever known and obviously survives. And so I avoided it for a few years. And then when I was almost 13, I picked it up and I read the first five pages and thought, no, that's really boring. And then a few months I tried again. And about 20 pages in, I was hooked. And I could not put the book down. I finished it. It's 730 pages. I finished it in about 3 days. It's the fastest I'd ever read anything. And I wasn't a very strong reader as a child. And I didn't like fantasy that much. And after I read this, I read through the other two books in the series and then started Raymond E. Feist and Margaret Weiss and Tracy Hickman with the Dragonlance Chronicles and Forgotten Realms and Pern and David Eddings, anything I could find. It was fascinating. I couldn't believe how realistic he'd made these things sound when they were so fantastic to conceive of.
Mm-hmm. Did you move on to Elfstones and all the other ones?
Yeah. My brothers bought me the original trilogy. So I read Sword of Shannara and then quickly went on to the other two. And then every year Terry Brooks came out with a new book. I would reread all of the older ones. So I've read The Sword of Shannara about 8 or 9 times.
And
so
does it
point.
Does it still have the same magic for you?
It does, but I know the story too well. The last time I read it was a few years ago, and I had it memorized to the point where about halfway through I had to stop because I knew everything that was going to happen. So basically I didn't really like fantasy. Like, I'd read a few fantasy novels before this, but Terry Brooks was the one that showed me that fantasy really had a lot of depth to it. I started reading a lot of fantasy and finding philosophy and just interesting ideas and quotes and whatnot that I could quote back at people and, you know, sort of annoy them with my intelligent aura, which of course didn't work, but I tried. I got into science fiction more in high school and university, but I am very much a fantasy girl.
Gotcha. What did you think of the later books in that series?
I read the original series, and then I read The Heritage. Then I kind of lost track for a little bit, and when I went back, I didn't like those ones so much. I really like his newer ones, the Genesis.
Okay.
He's going back to the original feel of the stories. But I've only read the first one. I haven't had time to go to the second and third yet.
Gotcha. Lisa, are you back?
I'm back. Sorry about the ID10 error there.
That's okay. Jessica, I had one more thought for you. So the Brooks books are supposed to be like the far, far future of our Earth, correct?
Right.
Yeah, that's what I thought. I didn't like Jarkarus and all that kind of stuff. I tried to get into it, but not so much. So, Lisa, now that you're back, let's talk to you. What was your gateway book?
That would be Childhood's End by Arthur C. Clarke.
Nice.
I read it about the same time as I discovered Asimov's Foundation series, but I'd have to say Childhood's End in 2001 and 2010 and a bunch of the other ones sort of edged all that out. I was fascinated by the whole idea, the famous Clarke quote about how, you know, magic can be, you know, explained away with science and that it's all a matter of your perspective. And that that kind of core idea combined with the scope of, you know, both Clarke's and Asimov's novels just it was amazing to me as a teenager. And then when I was a senior in high school, we had to do our kind of senior theme, had to pick an author, read five books, come up with something they all had in common. And I did Arthur C. Clarke, but out of that handful of books, it was Childhood's End that really stood out for me.
Nice. Have you reread them?
I reread Childhood's End, and I loved it just as much. I've read it two or three times now, but I'm not a big rereader.
Gotcha.
How did you find that book?
How did I find it?
Yeah.
I think it was 2001, the movie, and then I found out about Clarke himself and looked at his other books that he'd written. And I'm pretty, you know, I think I just found it in the school library. My mom is a librarian. She was always bringing home really cool books. I read the Foundation series with her and my brother. All three of us at the same time just gobbled it up, couldn't get enough of it. So there were always books around.
What did you think of Eli spouting Clarke on Stargate Universe?
It was awesome.
Wasn't it?
Yes.
That was fantastic. I loved that
song. I giggled. It was great.
Fred, tell us about tell us about your first book, and I'll bet you it's Arthur C. Clarke.
Well, there you would be wrong. Actually, how it all started was I went to the library with my mother once, and she took out a mystery book for me that I really liked, returned it, and a few weeks later I wanted to reread it, but silly me, I never wrote down the title. So the librarians say, what was it? Rub-a-dub-dub, 3 minutes in a tub, and like, you know, take me seriously, please. And I noticed all these books on the shelves with these funny little symbols on the side, look like atoms and rocket ships. So I took it out and opened it up, and it was all about this generation ship that had been launched off in 2008 and disappeared. And years later, this man's looking at a plaque for the dedication of the ship, wondering whatever happened to it. He goes off on an expedition. They run into a planet with mysterious creatures that look like humans that have telepathic powers. And that was a wonderful book. And then I went on to Starman's Son by Andre Norton and Starborn. And then Arthur C. Clarke, Islands in the Sky. And then Robert A. Heinlein, The Rolling Stones. But for years and years, I never knew what that first book was. Until in college, Ace started reprinting books. I picked up this book called Rocket to Limbo by Alan E. Norse, opened it up, and about three paragraphs in, I'm like, God damn, that's the one! So yes, I have reread it, and nice. It was as interesting the second time around and the third time around as it was the first. And this was written in 1957, and Norse had things like planetary ecologists as one of the crew members. And, you know, kind of realistic telepathic powers, you know, not like superpowers, but, you know, more realistic than many people depict it, as well as, you know, 2008 seemed to be way off in the future then, and, you know, just hooked me for the entire rest of my life.
Do you ever get bummed by reading, you know, or remembering those books that you read that were set in, like, 2008, 2005, and then you hit those in those dates, and then, like, none of that stuff is happening, and you're kind of pissed?
Well, not so much annoyed. I mean, weirdly enough, that Space Dog podcast or whatever site, the SF Oral History Society, they put up, I think they're the ones that put up this talk between Clarke and Toefler, Margaret Mead, and I think
the fourth person. That.
So I actually listened to that tonight, and it was kind of weird to hear them talking in 1970 about, you know, 2001. And it was pointed out pretty much that maybe we wouldn't have, some of the things that they predict in science fiction, but other things would be just as wonderful. And, another podcast I heard recently, they pointed out that, hey, we don't have Captain Kirk, but our cell phones are way cooler than his communicator.
Yeah.
I mean, our cell phones have cameras in them.
You don't know what his communicator had in it. It could have had a camera.
Oh, come on. I had the Franz Joseph tech manual. I know what it had in it.
Can you see, like, the Romulans attacking and Spock is texting someone?
I've always wanted to see a Federation ship or some starship in a show getting ready to go into battle, and just as they do, a little message comes up on the view screen saying, your weapon system has an upgrade available.
Blue
screen of death.
Yes.
You guys just caused two things to flash in my mind. One was Spock sexting. Which I imagined was, him sitting there typing, my two fingers rubbing slowly up the top of your two fingers. No. And then the other one was, in the middle of a battle, suddenly a little message pops up on the screen that says, "Just kidding, LOL." Matthew, how about you?
Okay, well, my answer is only like 2 seconds long, so I'm going to elaborate a bit.
Okay.
We had a bunch of old books in the house when I was very young. The first things, besides, like the Disney stuff and things that I learned to read on, I remember picking out books about mythology, about constellations in space and dinosaurs. So I was, I was getting my brain ready for what was later to come. I did a little bit of Zorro and Peter Pan when I was very young, but mostly I was a hardcore comic book guy, and that carried me for years until I'm guessing maybe when I was about 13, all my friends were reading novels and I had no interest, but somebody really talked up this one book or this series, so I had to check out the first book. And it turned out to be A Spell for Chameleon by Piers Anthony, which is, Piers Anthony is fantastic for adolescent boys because there's all the magic and the wonder, plus there's sex, that was, your parents had no idea that there was sex going on in these books when they looked at the covers, so that was awesome. I enjoyed the book, but I never went on with the Xanth series. I tried a couple of his other books. I liked the Bio of a Space Tyrant series. I read that whole thing. But really, kind of after that, I really got into the more hardcore science fiction, like Forever War. I got into Julian May's stuff very seriously. I got into the science fiction book club early on and just checked out all sorts of stuff. But in my mind, the first book that turned me on to this whole thing was Spell for Chameleon.
Very cool. Let's go to Karen.
Hey, so I've got sort of the official answer and then a funny answer. So the official answer is short. I started with I'd always read fantasy and stuff at home. Hobbit, Tolkien, Narnia, etc. And then, but the first science fiction book that I really remember going, wow, was Madeline Wengel's A Wrinkle in Time. Mm-hmm. And upon rereading, that holds up half decently. There are multiple layers there, which is actually makes it, age a little better than a lot of books that are written for, 6 to 10 year olds. But the funnier story is that there was one time in middle school I had had a fallout with my mom, and her way of punishing me, she couldn't just make me go to my room, and she couldn't just take away the TV because I didn't care. And she said, "You can't read any books for pleasure until you've done X." And I was like, oh, that's, hey, other parents love it when their kids read. What the heck? So I moped along to school like you do when you're 13, and I was talking to my social studies teacher, and he was like, oh, well, yeah, that kind of sucks. Here, come back after lunch. And so I did. And he had brought this huge box of all his old SF and fantasy books that he was just going to get rid of. And he just said, hey, take whatever you want.
Wow.
And it was full of Piers Anthony and Asimov and Clark and Heinlein and all this stuff. And I pretty much spent the rest of the semester just reading through it. yeah, loved Clark, Childhood End, loved Asimov, the robot stories. I got Piers Anthony. I really enjoyed his On a Pale Horse, The Incarnations of Immortality. Mm-hmm. But Taro and Biro of the Space Tyrant were that was a little much for me. But I will always remember very fondly that particular teacher, Mr. Griffin. He was a real lifesaver at that point.
Awesome. Hey, Jeff.
Yes.
You ready?
Well, the Gateway book is, oddly enough, Gateway. but I have to preface that a little bit because in my childhood, I had read, you know, there were always science fiction stories in some of the school books I read. And I had read Wrinkle in Time and I read a lot of comic books and I read a lot of the pulps like Larry was talking about. But I hadn't really, the whole idea of science fiction as a genre hadn't really struck me. It all sort of struck me as adventure. And I watched Star Trek when I was a kid, and I was in the Star Trek fan club, and somebody managed to get a hold of a 16mm copy of the trailer for Star Wars, which, if anyone remembers, the trailer was like a year before the movie actually came mm-hmm. out. And shortly after that was when the novelization came out, the one that, quote, George Lucas, unquote, wrote. And I read that novelization, and I really liked it.
Well, it changes the whole tone. I mean, you realize that Biggs really is the hero.
Yeah. And I'm in a bookstore one day. And pardon me, it was not a bookstore. It was a little science fiction book gathering that they were having somewhere. And I saw the cover of Gateway and I really liked it, thinking it was going to be another grand sweeping adventure story. And I was, you know, I was pretty well versed in that stuff at this point. And I read it. And in the course of about 3 weeks, I read it and I read Inherit the Stars by James Hogan.
Ooh, that must have been some culture shock.
Two of those books. Are you kidding me? I had never read something that wasn't really an adventure story that dealt with these really big ideas that were bigger than anything else and how dreaded they could be if when confronted with them. So over the course of that was summer of 77. Star Wars comes out. I love it and all that stuff. But I'm reading Time Storm, and at this point I met some other guys in a fan club, and they turned me on to Asimov and Clark. Strangely enough, my first Arthur C. Clarke book was Imperial Earth, and then someone turned me on to Childhood's End and Rendezvous with Rama and stuff like that. But Gateway was real. One other thing I have to add to this was that my freshman year of high school, before Star Wars came out, I read Salem's Lot. Which back then books had radio commercials and yep. There was a radio commercial I heard, you know, where they were saying, you know, the children are vanishing and there are strange sucking sounds in the night. And I was like, what is this all about? And I went grocery
shopping. They're snogging.
I went grocery shopping with my mother, and Salem's Lot, the original paperback, didn't have the title on the cover. It was just the embossed girl's face with a drop of blood on the corner of her mouth. So I grabbed it and I read it that year, and that sort of got me prepped for reading heavier stuff. You know, I'd never read horror along those lines before.
I read
Gateway, and it just knocked me out. I was like, "Are you kidding me?" And the one other thing that really opened my mind, I had read a lot of comics, like Matthew and Larry had mentioned, but it wasn't until late 79, early 80. When heavy metal started getting published, and I started reading that, and that really turned me on to the possibilities of the genre in general. And I was a hopeless case after that. So
I still think that the TV adaptation of Salem's Lot in the 70s mm-hmm. was one of the best and scariest ever.
It was very scary. There were some significantly, truly, truly scary parts in that whole thing.
All right. So we got to finish this up. We got to let John DiNardo talk about his gateway book, Barbarella.
Is that a book? Was there a novelization of that? Did Peter David do that?
No, it was a comic book.
No, Alan Dean Foster.
I wish I could say I had a specific book that I read that just like opened up the world of sci-fi and fantasy for me, but it's all kind of a blur. One of the earliest books I remember reading was The Hobbit, which was a book assignment in sixth grade, and so I was 11.
Public school?
Yes, public school.
Yeah, that figures, because I read it in the fourth grade.
It was one of the few books that I was assigned that I actually liked.
Yeah, me too.
Maybe Lord of the Flies being another one in high school. But one of the things I liked about that book was not only the story and the adventure, and which was all new to me, but I think because the English teacher who assigned it would read some of it to us in class, and she would act out the voices, right? So she did a really mean Gollum and stuff like that. So that made it really enjoyable for me. I think because
did she sing
of that
song.
Yeah,
did
I think
sing that song where there's a whip, there's a way.
That she didn't do, but you know, she. I think she kind
of
sang.
Frodo of the nine song. Fingers and the Ring of Doom.
That's the Lord of the Rings, not the Hobbit.
Yeah.
Well, so
oh
I did, so
snap!
But it's a song.
I did go on to read the Lord of the Rings because of that. And that's when I started making trips to the bookstores. And so that's where I found, I think it was Caves of Steel or Foundation. So one of the robot or Foundation novels was my first sci-fi book. And that, I mean, I devoured those. And from then on, it was going on to other early books like Ringworld and Gateway that were still in print back then.
Did you ever reread any of them?
I reread The Hobbit several years later. I enjoyed it almost as much, just not as much because I knew it was coming, you know, that kind of thing. There were no surprises. Caves of Steel I did reread, and I was able to appreciate it a little more, I think, just for the construction of it when I read it years later. And I decided to read every Asimov robot and Foundation novel in existence, even the associated ones that like Roger McBride Allen did some, and you know, the Three Bs did some, and all that stuff. So that's when I reread those. And then I think I haven't read Asimov since. Asimov'd out. And then I kind of reread Gateway, I think, years later, and enjoyed that as well. But I think Ringworld was probably my first hard sci-fi. I guess you could classify that as hard sci-fi, right? I mean, there's a lot of description of the ring world and all that stuff. So that was probably my first hard sci-fi novel. And even from that early age, I was more liking science fiction more than fantasy, which still is kind of true today.
Yep. My first was fourth grade. I read The Chronicles of Narnia and The Hobbit. And then I never read The Chronicles of Narnia again. But I did reread The Hobbit several times. And then I didn't read any more until the seventh grade when my English teacher said, well, did you know that there's this other thing called Lord of the Rings? And I said, no. She said, well, you should read it. And then I reread that a bunch of times because I love that too. But then I didn't read anything, you know, new for, I was like reading Encyclopedia Brown and weird stuff like that. And then came along Han Solo at Star's End. So I didn't actually read the Star Wars novel. I read the prequel Han Solo novels, Star's End, Solo's Revenge, and The Lost Legacy. I don't know if you guys have ever read those. Brian Daley. Yep. And it kind of set up. It was kind of interesting. It's like it's almost like Lucas said, you can have the characters of Han Solo and Chewbacca, but you can't have them in the Empire or anywhere near anybody else. So they created the corporate sector.
Brian Daley and I saw Star Wars at the same theater, same day, same showing.
Wow.
But we didn't know each other.
Well, I really enjoyed those books. And then, of course, billions and billions of comic books. And then X-Files and Star Trek and Star Wars novels. And then didn't really get back into any kind of epic anything until I read The Dragon Stone by Dennis L. McKiernan in 2000.
You know, something else just dawned on me staring here at my bookshelf, and that also either 77 or early 78, somebody got me a paperback copy of the anthology, again, Dangerous Visions, Volume 2, which had come out in 72. And I think that probably really scarred me for life.
You think that scarred you?
Is that what you're blaming this week? Okay.
So Fred, I'm like 11 years old or 12, and my mom knows that I really like to read books. And some friend at the bar, she was a bartender at the time, gives her a book and says, here, you know, your son likes to read. He might like this. So she brings this book home and she says, here, I don't know if you like this or not, but you can try it. And I said, oh, okay. And I look at it and it had an interesting cover. It had a clown on the cover and it was Stephen King's It.
Oh, yeah. There you go.
And I read maybe 100 pages of that. And I it was like one of those things where you, like Joey, I had to put it in the freezer and shut the door.
You know, there's a common theme, I think, in all of our stories is that there was someone there to foster the love of reading in us, I think. I mean, most cases, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
Which is...
absolutely.
Which I think I'm thankful for.
That was a different podcast. All right, well, I think this one's gone on long enough and it's time to put it out of its misery. Thanks to everybody for coming on. Thank you, John, Larry, Lisa, Karen, Jessica, Jeff, and Fred, and Matt, and anybody else who dropped out when I wasn't looking.
Thank you.
Thank you, Patrick.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
And we'll figure something out for next week. Thanks, everybody.
Have a good night.
Bye.
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 And that's it for this show, episode 20 in the can. If you would like to share with us what your gateway genre novel was, feel free to call our voicemail line. That's 720-277-9082. And maybe we'll feature your voicemail in a future episode. Or, of course, you can always just head over to sfsignal.com and find the post for this episode and leave a comment. As for the song that I got wrong, I was actually thinking there was a song from The Hobbit, which is based on the poem that Bilbo wrote. The Road Goes Ever On and On. So here's that song. See you next week. Bye.
Roads go ever on, over rock and under tree, by caves where never sun has shone, by streams that never find the sea. Roads go ever on.